For sake of time, maybe perhaps I'll ask the first couple of questions to give you opportunity to formulate your thoughts, because there are a number of people I'm sure who will wish to ask questions. Maybe we'll work hard together to keep the questions a little shorter and concrete for our guests. If you wish a particular answer from a particular guest, please maybe make that clear. But for myself, just to begin, if I could ask each of you, I am violating my own rule, but if I could ask each of you, you've introduced us over the course of the weekend to many resources, to many names in the history of philosophy, to some contemporary writers. Obviously, you've done the hard work of moving through that literature and some of those names, but could you help us, because you two are authors and you two are reflecting on these things, just to help us remember, what's next for you? What are you writing? What are you working on that we might need to be aware of? We'll start maybe with you, Andrew, and go down.
Well, I'm a newbie to the writing project, but last month was set aside to writing up the material on the self that I presented earlier. And I'm very thankful to the Lord. Writing is a grind for me, but a month set aside, and it's pretty much done. So my hope, which is a far reach, is actually to find a non-Christian publisher for it. Because I have a very long postscript, which is an apology from the church that we colluded so badly in this whole thing. So it really, for me, works best with a non-Christian publisher in mind.
Okay. So, I've written off and on during my life, nothing as prolifically as Oz, but at different parts of my life, I've been reflecting on different things, and books have come out of it. The latest two that one is just out, and the other's coming out in January. The one just out is called Does Christianity Really Work? Kind of a difficult type. I could have answered yes and then, you know, given them a quick manuscript, but it was kind of challenging because we know that it does, but we don't want working to be the test of its truth. And we also know that Christians and many times parts of the church have failed dreadfully and have contributed to the non-working rather than the work. So that came out with Christian Focus. And then I've got a big one coming out called Created and Creating. Mark mentioned it earlier. The subtitle is A Biblical Theology of Culture. And so it's a romp through various cultural students and then mostly Bible studies trying to defend the cultural mandate in its different iterations as God's calling of humankind. And then the one I'm working on now is The Spirituality of Jazz.
I'm halfway through a book on freedom. The two talks I gave here were books addressed to the church, but I'm trying to write a book on freedom for the broader American public. I wrote one on sustainable freedom, but then in the debate that followed it, I realized that many Americans actually don't know what freedom actually is. So it's a relatively simple book, a checklist of 10 questions to ask, and it's quite clear which faith can answer all 10 and which simply can't answer any of them. That's what I'm writing on next, and after that I hope another book for Secrets.
Wonderful. Maybe one more question to each of you. So the conference this weekend has been helping us to think about Christian participation in the struggle for civilization. We've heard much about the change that's sweeping through North American culture, indeed Western culture. You've been addressing some of the particular issues. Andrew, you've been helping us to think about subversion and engagement. And yet, we live in a moment in which the Christian community is beginning to turn away from cultural engagement. There are various theologies in the life of the church which are calling into question what used to be called transformationalism or cultural engagement. Would you care to help us think about the rise of some of those movements and why it is that some within the church seem so unwilling to engage or maybe even so cautious against engaging?
I think it's the opposite, actually. I find many more people engaging well for the first time. In other words, the pietism of most of the 20th century was replaced by the politicization of the late 20th century and the early 21st century, and that failed. Those are the two extremes. I find a lot more people willing to think carefully and engage constructively. You're right. We have movements like Rod Reyes, Benedict Option, and you have a lot of Americans now talking, we're in exile. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolute rubbish. You are the majority in your own country, for heaven's sake, wake up and live Christianly. I think some of these sort of approaches are just plain stupid. And you can liberate people from this and just get them confidently engaging. Mm.
Thank you. Bill and Andrew.
Well, that's right. I totally agree. There is a movement that has made its way into certain circles, I think quite limited, but it's called the Two Kingdoms approach. And what it says, it's often a thoughtful critique of people who have become engaged in culture for the wrong reasons. But what it basically says by, I think, misappropriating Luther is that there are realms that are ruled differently, two basic realms ruled differently by the same Christ. The church, which is where he is primarily active, where he rules by his word, and the church's job is, you know, evangelism and preaching the word and prayer and so forth. And then the rest of society, government and so forth, are ruled indirectly by Christ or by the sword or by natural law. And the Bible doesn't have any direct word on what that should look like. Certainly not redeeming spheres of society or transforming them. And I think some of it is just the old pietism. Some of it's fear. You know, it's scary out there and safer, we think, inside the church, although, you know, we know that that's not true. And then some of it is just a sense that I want to go deeper in my Christian life, and I don't want to be encumbered. But Two Kingdoms is actually, in its most exaggerated form, very, very dangerous. It's a lack of love, a lack of desire to see change. It's responsible in some places for things like slavery. And so that's a movement. I hope it doesn't make its way too far into the church, but it's around.
I just add to the Two Kingdoms thing. In some respects, they're responding to a failure in the church in terms of we engage culture, we engage the world of ideas, and the secularization has just gone even further. So it's a bit of turn from that. There's nothing new under the sun, so this retreat engagement pattern you see through all of church history. I would say just generally, I think we can still do better within the church in terms of a theology of creation. We give a certain lip service to it, but I think it could become a lot more rigorous in terms of our preaching and our teaching.
Yes, I have a question. One of the recurring themes that I've heard throughout my life pertaining to the persecuted church is that that's really almost something that the church needs to kind of whip us into shape, so to speak, so that we are become not of the world. And there's almost an unspoken idea that goes along with that we should almost be praying for persecution. I've never quite been able to bring myself to do that. So I wonder, does that impact perhaps the way that we maybe engage or disengage in culture? Do we have on this, in the Western culture, this idea that maybe we're a little guilty because we haven't been persecuted? And then at the same time, I've also heard someone recently who pointed out that historically, the areas that have most persecuted the church hasn't seen a tremendous amount of growth in the churches. So it almost seems like there's a dichotomy here between how do we view persecution and how does that maybe, or thinking about that, impact how we engage in culture?
I can start. This is really Oz's subject.
I'm just a
Well, what's our responsibility towards the persecuted church? Is it possible that we are so comfortable that we need to seek persecution? And is it not true that the places in the world where persecution occurs is a place of church growth? I'm very hesitant to say things like that. You know, Tertullian famously said that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. It can be, has been. Often great persecution brings wonderful results, but it can not be as well. There's awful examples in history of persecution where nobody's recovered, the church least of all. So I don't think we should have the formula that persecution is good for us. I think rather we should say when it happens, we need to be prepared. 1 Peter 3:15 and many other places. And that preparation could occur in comfortable places where we don't think we're persecuted, but we really are, culturally, or in uncomfortable places where the persecution is palpable. And whatever the case, I think the church worldwide has a responsibility for the church worldwide. The American church has a responsibility for parts of the world where the church is severely persecuted. Doesn't mean we can go to every battle and fight every fire, but it does mean that we should be about helping brothers and sisters around the world who are enduring very, very hard persecution in all kinds of ways that we should be doing that. But anyway, what you're not trying to do, I'm sure, is to romanticize persecution.
I think the only thing I'd add is in the history of the church, we have our martyrs, and I think paying attention to them, going way back to the past, but martyrs today, they're very important as part of our narrative. These are people who gave their lives for the sake of Christ. So I have a friend who spent a year just thinking about the martyrs, and he said it was incredibly helpful for him in his own life of service to Christ. He doesn't want it, but he honored them. And I think traditionally that's been important. So I'd say it's okay to think about the martyrs.
Many Christians on the front line of engagement are teaching in public schools, but they may want to do so subversively, putting a pebble in the shoes of students and doing pre-evangelism from their respective disciplines. And do you know of any resources that would help math or physics or language arts teachers do this pre-evangelism in public schools?
I think certainly there are in some public schools prejudices against openly expressing your Christian faith, and Christians have to decide how to navigate those waters. I have a friend who teaches in the school system in New York, and they were told recently that they had to use a reader that said, "Johnny has two mothers," and then went on with that. And my friend decided, instead of refusing and getting fired, that she would try to work with this book and with this idea and use it as an opportunity to explain family. I don't know how she did it. You'd have to be very gifted, more than I am, to do that, because it's really tough. But I do think generally, if you are a Christian in a system where that's a problem, try as much as you can to stay and seek opportunities. I was a school teacher, but blessedly in a private school, and there was a general political correctness to it, but I got away with a lot just because I didn't provoke. You know, I just, in 10 years of teaching, the only opposition I got was from a liberal Protestant minister who, one of his parishioners was a daughter who went to the school and reported to him that she was being taught by a fundamentalist. So I consider that an honor. But the school didn't worry about me. But this is a good story. There are a lot of very, very difficult stories. I'm not any more in education, and I don't know of resources for math teachers and curricula. There's quite an industry of resources for a Christian approach to different subjects, and I could probably direct you there, but I'll bet there's people in this room who would know where to go for those things.
I would just add, you mentioned math and physics, and I cannot help you there for sure. But one of the great resources all of us have is the question. And I think one of the great tools of an educator is to leave a good question in the classroom. And it doesn't have to be a question that has religious language in it. I just think we have to continue to try and master the art of questions. It's one of the greatest educative tools we have. Just ask the right question.
We become accustomed to the idea, the concept that God has two books, Revelation and Nature. He speaks to us. Are we missing a third book? And is it culture? And to what extent can we say that God is communicating to his world through this thing called culture?
I would say the category of general revelation, which is a different way of putting it, would include culture. So I sense the two books, I think traditionally, the book of nature has included all revelation and creation that's not the special revelation of the Bible. That's how I read it.
Is there anything we can learn from the Russian Orthodox, our brothers in the East? We focus a lot today on the Western Church, but going off the persecution question, it wasn't until recently that the Soviet Union ceased to exist and stopped murdering priests. Is there anything that we can learn from that side of the world?
Enormous amounts. I know it's fashionable to criticize Trump's love of Putin, and there's a lot of truth to the criticism, but I actually think there's a heritage in Russia that has transcended the Soviet phase and is able to transcend the Putin phase, and it's in many places. It's of course in the unbelievable beauty of the worship of the Orthodox churches. It's in the literature of the great Russian authors, both from the 19th century when they were much more free to write as Christians, Dostoevsky, Gogol, but also in the exiled Russians who went to Paris and places like that, who wrote extraordinary critiques of history and novels and I think it has just a great deal to offer us. It's Russia is sadly, tragically persecuted place in so many ways, but there's a spirit there that I think survives much of that and is able to nurture the West from the courage that was exhibited.
Yes, hi. I am a student at Covenant Seminary, and so I wanted to say, first of all, thank you to all three of you for being here today and this weekend. Now, if I could address all three of you, I had a question with regard to the fact that what part of your presentations this weekend could you possibly put into context of your personal story, or to put it another way, as Andrew has alluded to this morning, that the work of a cultural apologist is to be prophetic in his or her voice. What part, even though we are very careful not to say we are, for example, Jeremiah of the Bible. But what part of your stories or presentations that you have presented here would you possibly be able to cast yourself maybe as even perhaps a weeping prophet?
I've been an academic all my life, so that probably explains a lot of things. I've always sensed my calling was to help not only inform but form young people with a sensitivity and awareness and a certain number of skills that will help make a difference to human flourishing. I think the best academics have a sense that they're not just out there to do pure research and escape in other ways, but they're there to help maybe give some shape to the future by training and helping young people to make judgments. I don't know if you're supposed to have a favorite tribe of Israel, but if you could, mine would be the children of Issachar, because as you know, when they were being enumerated in terms of their faithfulness to David, each of them had an epithet, and the sons of Issachar were known to discern the times, or understand, it's a wonderful Hebrew word, in order to tell Israel what she was to do. And I think what I've tried to do very, very, very poorly is to identify people who have the gift of learning and help them to understand the times so that not only they can tell others but themselves where they should go ahead. So and in my vision, I depend on people like Oz and Andrew to give me the insights as to some of what's happening as they do it as prophets, and then I go and apply it to the young people whose charge I've been honored with having.
That's a hard question you asked. One of my main mentors in terms of engaging culture is Francis Schaeffer. We've mentioned him a lot this weekend. And he engaged cultural movements very deeply, but it was never simply an intellectual exercise for him. He was actually distressed, visibly distressed, as he engaged the ideas of his times, because he saw the implications of them. This touched real life. It was devastating to people. And I found that model very helpful for myself. And the more I see where we are, the more distressed I feel about it. I feel distressed for my own children. This is the world they live in. And I would say as we engage and as we think, we have to do that as whole beings with our imagination, our emotions, our hearts. We have to feel the distress of this generation. And I think that'll make us better communicators. It'll draw forth more love and compassion and condemnation where it's needed. This is so bad. We have to condemn it because it's devastating lives.
Your last statement there is a good segue to my question, which is particularly regarding the youth, which a lot of people who work in youth ministry, and quite frankly, a lot of parents are reporting this issue of their kids basically not keeping the faith once they leave the home, basically not able to really engage objections to the faith. And one theory is that it seems to me that we're teaching kids and young adults nowadays is not really, we're not really teaching them to engage the culture. We're pretty much just kind of pulling them back from the culture, such that when they get into the culture, their faith has not been built on a rock, and they're basically just kind of falling apart. So question is, what advice, what encouragement, or what have you discovered in your study that could be helpful for those who are doing ministry to young adults?
I have something very brief connected to films. Films are a huge part of our cultural life, and we need to be careful by following the certificates. So you got the PG, and many Christian parents are incredibly naive. They think we can put our kids in front of a U film and we don't even need to engage them on that. But if it's a PG or a 12 or a 15, then it's getting dodgy. And it's a purely moral way of looking at the film. And I'd say be careful with some of those U films, because they're full of poisonous value. Universal, G, anybody can watch it. It's basically, this is a harmless film. And there's many parents, many Christian parents, who are totally naive. You need to watch those films with your children, your young children, and discuss them.
That's a really, really challenging question, because I think each of us struggles with communicating the message to the next generation, as that psalm over there says. And I don't think there's a silver bullet, honestly. A lot of things can be done. Films, churches need to have ways to educate kids that are going off to college in worldview thinking, and there's a lot of things to do. It's going to sound trite, and I don't think it is. I was in youth work for many, many years, and I found the thing that consistently communicated something authentic to our young people about the Christian faith was that wonderful combination of love and consistency that they needed. You know, if you're inconsistent in applying the rules, you know, you'll confuse a child. But if you are a rulesy person and just say no, but you don't have, you know, tons of love and affirmation, you're going to turn them into resentful people. So that's the way I think you can avoid that, is that incredible biblical combination of love and consistency, whatever you're teaching and whatever you're doing.
The other suggestion said there's plenty of tests, tiny things, or I just call them. First, Schaefer often used to say, keep them ahead of the game. In other words, for people growing up, it's what surprises them. They think, oh, I wasn't told that. First, you pay this in the solid, but what, or whatever. Keep them just ahead of the game, knowing what the professors are like. They say they're not surprised and they're ready for it. The second tip would be what Andrew said this morning, teach the roots. Too much apologetics is giving specific answers A to a specific objection B or whatever, rather than teaching the roots of these things, and everything to vary on the roots. I think that's what the key is there. People aren't surprised. Schiff used to say there aren't any really new questions for people. Very rarely brought out on campuses.
Hi, thank you all. Dr. Fellows, this may be more a question for you, but I'll throw it out to all three of you. You spoke on the on presuppositions, what we could call the preconditions for culture, or preconditions for intelligence, however you want to go down that road. What role, or I could probably say priority. I haven't heard it explicitly, of course, in less than a day and a half to be able to do this, but what role or priority does Trinitarian theology specifically play in a cultural apologetic as we engage unbelievers in our unbelieving culture?
Crucial. Absolutely crucial.
Can he say more?
Well, the Trinity is at the center of reality. So we should expect to see a Trinitarian dimension through God's created reality. So the principle that LaBrie, going back to Schaefer, worked out is unity and diversity. And you could see the whole fabric of European society in some way rooted in that principle. It gave birth to all kinds of things. So it's an absolutely central, it's not just an idea, it's a reality. Reality of persons, but it's just key to everything. It has to be.
Would you join me in thanking our guests for their answers and for their lectures?